Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer.
Me say war not the answer.
Politician and them bobo nyatin, yeah. War is not the answer. I don't know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. Me say the politician and them start drop them bomb, yeah. War is not the answer. I don't know what the solution Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And I recall during the Cold War spending quite a lot of time with Soviet officials, at least those that one was authorized to speak with, like the Arbatov and the USA Canada Institute people. And invariably, you got the impression that they were more comfortable, the Soviets were more comfortable dealing with Republican foreign policy people and the Republican National Security Council and Republican presidents than they were with Democrats, who they thought were unreliable. And I'm just wondering at this point whether, given the disarray in the Republican Party, I don't think that, you know, that the kind of deep bench that the Republicans used to have in terms of their national security people on various Republican presidencies, that no longer exists, I don't think. But on the Democratic side, it seems that you still have this tendency that the Democrats have always had to overcompensate, whether it was during the Cold War that they didn't want to look soft on the communists, and during the so-called War on Terror, they didn't want to look soft on the terrorists. And now it looks like they don't want to be soft on Kim Jong-un, which, given the stakes, makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. This is an inexcusable crisis, and perhaps the only thing worse than the crisis itself diplomatically is the way it's been reported and handled by the American media. Let me just recall a little bit of history here, because I think it's quite relevant. The dominant historical fact, of course, for Korea is that 3 million Koreans lost their lives in the Korean War. This is the indelible fact of modern Korean history. It's always there. The second relatively unreported reality was in a rather obscure and I think neglected Associated Press interview with Siegfried Hecker, who was a former director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. You probably know Sig, who has made a study of the North Korean nuclear program. And in this interview, was quite explicit in saying that yes, they may have a few weapons, but they've got a definite deficiency in fissile material. They're not really a nuclear threat, miniaturizing and doing the things they have to do technically to get those weapons on board missiles and to deliver them and all the rest. Is a daunting task, and they're still far away from any significant threat. So that specter, that looming danger of a North Korean nuclear strike, I think needs to be put in perspective. But let me go back for a moment and just look at the history of this, because it's a bipartisan disaster under both Democrats and Republicans. Only a few years ago, relatively speaking, 1994, we had a virtual thaw. You may remember that the grandfather of the princeling here, Kim Il-sung, approached the Clinton administration. There was a thaw in relations with South Korea as well. By the year 2000, there was an actual exchange of visits. The number two man in Pyongyang came to Washington. Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, went to Pyongyang, the first visit of its kind, of course, in history. But the Clinton administration dropped the ball on that diplomacy completely. The essential deal was to get the North Koreans out of the nuclear business, out of nuclear arms completely, in return for recognition and for some kind of detente, some kind of stabilizing agreement in East Asia. That didn't happen. The Clinton administration, along with a number of other issues, ignored this one to its end. The advent then of the Bush administration, brought us, of course, the axis of evil, North Korea defined as one of those evil regimes that had to be overthrown. And nothing was done about that. There was a complete cutoff of relations, of course, and by 2006, North Korea did indeed have a bomb. The following year, there was some hope. This is an up and down history, Ian. By 2007, we began the six-party talks: China, Japan, Russia, along with North and South Korea and the United States. There was actually an agreement to shut down a part of the nuclear facility, this cooling tower at Yongbyon that we've seen again and again in film footage being blown up, was blown up as part of that agreement. But with the advent then of the Obama administration in 2009, all of that diplomacy was basically abandoned. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton adopted what she defined as strategic patience as the U.S. policy toward Pyongyang. It was all predicated, of course, on the expectation of an imminent collapse of the regime in the succession crisis when Kim Jong-il died and his son took over. The collapse didn't happen. I think it's a classic case of no irrelevant experience being left behind here in American foreign policy. We never really understood the nature of this regime. Yes, it's brutal. Yes, it's a dictatorship. Yes, it's this absolutely exotic amalgam of a monarchy and a communist state. On the other hand, there is an element here which harkens back to what we know now from the archives of Stalinist Russia. There is an element of popular support, of nationalist rallying around the hereditary leader. There's a very, very strong military as well as a strong communist party that vie for control. This is not a collapsing or a dilapidated regime. It's proven its longevity over time. And, of course, the calculus of the Obama people, none of whom knew very much about Korea, North or South, that calculus was to rely on some kind of imminent collapse rather than to do anything at all to de-escalate or to defang the very significant threat that was posed. Now, we had a crisis like this at the end of 2010. The irony of that one, which ended, of course, after an exercise and after North Korean provocations in response to that, the irony was that quietly behind the scenes, we now know, there was an American delegation of former high officials, many of whom knew Korea, who had gone privately to Pyongyang and worked out an agreement by which the North Koreans would begin to ship out their spent fuel rods in return for, again, a normalization of relations, same thing they've been asking for years and years and years. You may remember that that the princeling here said to Dennis Rodman, our only diplomatic contact with them in recent years, have Obama call me. This is the essence of North Korea's policy toward the United States. They want desperately some kind of stabilization of their situation. They're suffering under the sanctions, and when they exploded their third bomb in this test in February, and of course when they sent the rocket up in December, the response of the international community and of the United States was to, as we do with Iran, was to ratchet down still more the sanctions, which led to this current, I would call it an escalation, because I think it's probably more serious than any confrontation we've seen on the Korean Peninsula since the end of the Korean War.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. So, again, though, back to the what kind of a bench that we have in terms of foreign policy and national security advice President Obama's getting. I mean, all of his senior advisors on national security and foreign policy, all of them, without exception, I believe, were in favor of the Iraq War, Obama being the only one who wasn't. That doesn't, I think, bode well. And it seems that you've got a bit of a repeat of history here, because when you talked about the deals that almost got completed under Clinton at the end there, that was preceded by another crisis in 1994, where you had people like Joe Nye at Harvard, one of the Democrats' foreign policy gurus, calling for a preemptively strike and remove with nuclear weapons any possibility of a North Korean nuclear program. And things got really tense there. Jimmy Carter had to go over to North Korea and intervene. So, you know, it goes back to what I was talking to Bob Baer about, is that we almost had a nuclear war with Russia, just blundering through an exercise that they misinterpreted, but we don't understand how other people see us. So there's a history here of even what Clinton did. And again, it gets back to this idea that I don't think the president's getting good advice.
Well, there's literally no one around him who knows Korea as a country, as a history, really, and there's really no one around him of any rank who knows East Asia. This is obviously not just a story of the two Koreas. The backstory here is the danger that, in response to this continued sort of mad cadence that we've gotten into with North Korea, that both the Japanese and the South Koreans may be eventually provoked to go nuclear themselves. It seems an unthinkable thing, but it's certainly there in the geopolitical background. You've got a president now, a daughter of Park Chung-hee, a conservative woman in Seoul, who is not a force for détente and for reconciliation. A different attitude in South Korea. Each time these provocations ratchet up a bit more, the sinking of the South Korean vessel in 2010 that was so provocative. This is not the Korea that it was in the 1990s when Clinton made what progress he made. And as you just pointed out, it was a very dangerous era then. I think it's useful to remember that you can't deal with any of these states without some kind of expertise. The last genuine expertise that any American president had was from Ambassador Christopher Hill. You remember that figure who was involved in some of these negotiations over the years. There's no one now of any stature who knows this new regime. Obviously, the success of the succession has rather shocked, taken Washington by surprise, how strong the new young leader is, how forceful and how bold, how practiced he seems to be in the politics of provocation. But I think there's absolutely no question that American policy for the last 30 years in Korea has failed and failed miserably. It's become now, Ian, and in terms of the inner reality here, the purview of sort of second-rate people in the Department of State and the field people in the Pentagon, the field commanders, as Bob Baer pointed out, who are invariably belligerent as well as uninformed. There's no real genuine expertise at the top or even in the middle, but we're going to have to talk to these people. It's absolutely insane that there should be any kind of confrontation like this, risking what it does, and to count on the Chinese once again to come in the back door and strong arm them, I think again is a sign of the lack of sophistication and understanding of the dynamic. The Chinese have a stake in North Korea in terms of a cheap labor pool and certainly their own prestige in Asia. These moves by the Obama administration in sending our stealth showcases there across the Pacific are just as threatening to the Chinese as they are to the Koreans. This is a show of American force and power, flexing of muscle, which is quite imperial in its method as well as its purpose. So the only sane course, of course, is to move away from this failed policy, to sit down again in the six-party forum, or even by back channels, which would be, I think, very effective, and talk to these people about an accommodation, a detente with Pyongyang, which I think can lead constructively to an abandonment of their nuclear program, to an erasure of this threat, such as it is, as it exists. But Bob Baer is absolutely right. The danger of an accidental war with one of the largest armies on the planet, the danger of a gradual escalation, a tit-for-tat with South Korea, the danger of drawing the Japanese in to the nuclear circle, I mean, all of these stakes are just enormously high.
Well, I spoke recently, Roger Morris, with the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea and former CIA station chief, Donald Gregg, who was George H.W. Bush's vice president when he was vice president under Reagan. It was his national security advisor. And he was actually very surprisingly dovish. And he actually, as a lifelong Republican, he went out of his way to say how disgusted he is with the current Republican Party, thinks they're nuts and wants nothing to do with them, and is still worried about the neocons. But most of all, he said that he's in regular touch with the North Koreans, but they recognize that he's not in a position of power. And he just says, you know, they want to be talked to. And he's worried that this White House is full of people who have the investment in this idea that this is a failed state, North Korea, that it's about to collapse, that this kid's, trying to prove himself, and that we can't reward bad behavior. So all of those tropes are still in play.
Absolutely, and I think they drastically underestimate the cost of an accidental war. The devastation to South Korea would be absolutely massive. There would be a general destabilization in the area. Russia and China, no longer the adversaries perhaps that they once were, but Russia and China but still, to some extent, patron powers of Pyongyang. The Russians have sold them a number of submarines. The Chinese obviously have a huge financial as well as political stake there. This has all the earmarks of what Bismarck called one of those damn little things in the Balkans that started World War One. It engages none of the superpowers in any vital way. This is not, North Korea is not a threat to the United States in any sense. It's not really even a threat to the Japanese or the South Koreans. But it does, as Bob Baer pointed out, it does have an absolutely permanent desire for legitimacy, for its own survival. It sees that survival as dependent, thank God, on some kind of action by the United States. We have the magic bullet here. We can supply without losing face, without any kind of major embarrassment. We can supply them with the kind of recognition, the kind of aid, the kind of detente and disarmament deal that will put this crisis to rest and all future crises. But we're not responding in a reasonable or constructive way. I don't have any idea what Obama is thinking at this point. It's quite puzzling. He doesn't have anyone around him to really tell him what to do.
And of course, if he does anything reasonable, the Republicans are going to scream, sell out, cowardice, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me just say, I think you're right about the Democrats and their perennial neuroses about the Republicans. But if there was ever a moment, this moment of ruin and racket ruin for the Republican Party, when a Democratic president can afford to practice some kind of statesmanship, it's now. And in a theater of the world that we can afford to do that. Now, of course, Obama's pivot toward Asia is not just a tougher stance toward the Chinese. It can be a permanent nuclear free zone in North Asia, and that could earn him his Nobel Prize for real.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about greater access now to Plan B, the so-called morning after pill. At the same time, there appears to be a renewed war on abortion rights across the country.
Strikes now, so it would strike it.